Well, thank you very much for coming on the workshop regarding the Baltics and Southeastern Europe on the topic of energy security and the importance of renewables and how renewables can reduce the import dependency for these countries. Most of these countries in the last 10 years becoming the member states, and some of them are highly dependent on the import and the gas from the Russia. Some of them have their own capacities of gas, but there is obviously that these countries have a high potential in the renewables, and only some of them really use all these capacities for fulfilling the goals in Europe 2020 energy strategy. So I will first introduce my colleagues who will give some introductory words. From my right side is Rainer Vakra, MP Estonia, that will chair the Environment Committee in the Parliament of Estonia. He will be the porter of this workshop. Then Mr. Julian Popov. I will give a short biography of Mr. Julian Popov. He is chairman of the board of directors of Building Performance Institute Europe. He is a fellow of the European Climate Foundation and currently leads the Southeast Europe Grid Initiative, which catalyzes high-level energy policy cooperation among countries in wider Southeast Europe, including Turkey and the Western Balkans. Julian is a former Minister of Environment of Bulgaria, the founding CEO and current board member of the New Bulgarian University, the former chairman and current board member of the Bulgarian School of Politics, and the co-founder of the Tunisian School of Politics. From the left side, Natalie Hemmelers. Okay. Studied international business and European studies. He joined the European Biomass Association in March this year, where she is working as a policy advisor. Before joining Biomass Association, she worked at the European Commission, DG Energy, on international energy issues, and for several years in China in the business development field for European companies. From left side, also Pedro Diaz holds a management degree and has gained a wide experience in both the non-governmental and private sectors. He has previously worked in the heating sector, more specifically in gas retail and commercialization of heating equipment. Working for the solar thermal sector in his current position as ESTIF Secretary General, he combines both his professional experience and his passion for renewable energy. He is a great advocate for a more decentralized energy system in the consultation with the consumers for their benefit, while exploring the huge untapped potential of the renewable heat. And on the right side at the end, Burkhard Sanner, graduated as geologist in 1980 and first worked in engineering geology. Now he has about 30 years of experience in the fields of geothermal research and development and practical installation, about half of which he gained from working with the University of Gießen, Germany. Currently he is working in R&D and design of geothermal energy systems with UBGGBA Wetzlar, Germany. Mr. Sanner is one of the founders of the European Geothermal Energy Council and has been its president since 2004. So you can see that here are present experts that are in the field of the renewable energies that have really good potentials in these regions, from the Baltics to the Southeast Europe. And first, I will give the floor to Mr. Julian Popov to give us introductory expert input, about 15 minutes to hot the atmosphere in the audience. Please, Mr. Popov.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I had some plan what to say, and everything what I was planning to say was already said in fantastic presentations this morning, so I will have to say something else. I was delighted earlier about the thing that we heard about France politically blocking the interconnections with neighboring countries, because coming from Bulgaria and from Southeast Europe, it's always very kind of uplifting when you hear that this kind of things happen in other places as well. So it's not just us. And France being France and a big country and right in the middle obviously creates a bigger problem than we do. So that makes me quite cheerful. And talking about energy security, we were discussing this morning quite a lot about the value of the renewable energy, the potential that energy efficiency can offer. But when we start talking about energy security, I think we should kind of shift a little bit the focus, because now with the Ukrainian crisis, everybody started discussing and focusing on something that we've always been talking about, but never taking very seriously. So I think that we reached several tipping points, or turning points. Some are political, some are tipping points of our understanding what's going on around, and some are technological. I mean, the first one is that we realized that the idea that the Cold War is over is just not true. It came back in a completely different form, with different borders, but it's there. So we have to readjust massively on that. The other realization, I think, is that the idea that mechanically we can control the Middle East, which is the other source of energy for Europe, is not working. I mean, for anybody who is even superficially following what is happening with the Islamic State and the Middle Eastern issues, and how the big hopes that we had with the Arab Revolution somehow didn't materialize, we see that this region is very, very risky, not just for itself, but also for Europe. And this is a major route for our energy, for our gas, mainly energy. And the other thing, the third tipping point, I think, is our realization and the fact that growth and energy use have decoupled. So growth doesn't mean energy growth necessarily. Economic growth and energy use can go in different directions. We can have strong economic growth without increasing the use of energy, even decreasing it. In some cases, as we heard with energy efficiency, we can generate economic growth by decreasing of use of energy. So this is a completely different paradigm in which we're moving. And the third group of things that have changed dramatically are related to the cost of renewable energy. We heard this in the previous presentations that how dramatically the cost of energy went down, but we also heard the concern that the cost of renewable energy is a very heavy burden. So this is a situation in which, I mean, if you get drunk when you're 18, you can't be labeled for the rest of your life as an alcoholic. So if at some point the arrangements, the feed-in tariffs, the support schemes have been very high, if there was a period of time when governments and parliaments didn't manage to react to adjust feed-in tariffs and created an opportunity for sort of a boom in the renewable energy, which was probably not economically justified, we can't continue for the rest of our life to think about renewable energy as something expensive. In fact, renewable energy is cheaper than conventional energy. And I'm not saying that as some kind of a campaigner. I had even a couple of slides which I can show you, but I would encourage you to go and look at Lazard's annual assessment of levelized cost of electricity. I mean, Lazard is not Greenpeace. It's a leading investment bank, and they're not pushing for anything. They're just assessing the real situation. And comparing the cost of levelized electricity, you can see that solar energy, onshore wind energy, are already cheaper than conventional energy sources. So this turns everything around completely, because until now we were thinking, okay, what we should do in order to support renewable energy because it's good for the environment, it's good for the climate, it's good for something else. But now renewable energy starts making massive economic case. And that's very interesting for the different regions of Europe. I think in principle, when we talk about Europe, we have to divide Europe in kind of four corners, like that and like that, with a cross in the middle. There is a big difference between North and South. And also there is a big difference in East European countries between the Northeast European countries and Southern East European countries. What we have in Southern or Southeast Europe, we have a huge, huge renewable energy potential, which is cheap. So just one anecdote. In 2011, I think, I talked to the head of that time of the Bulgarian Parliamentary Economic Committee, and he said, look, we are doing everything possible to stop renewable energy. And this is a cross-party consensus. We can fight and hate each other about everything else, but we agree that we must stop, especially solar. Especially solar, that was 2011. 2012, Bulgaria became number one in the world in installation of solar per capita. So, when you look at UK, UK achieves tiny little bit every year as a result of very, very, very strong political will and push and so on. When you look at a country in Southeast Europe, even if the political will is in the opposite direction, the development is in employment and development of renewables. Of course, the story is more complex, but that's a trend. And you can see, as a result, we have very highly developed in Southeast Europe. I mean, in Romania, the biggest onshore wind power plant is in Romania. We live with this view that we'll get the wind from the north and the sun from the south, but that's not the case. I mean, anybody who's been to Greece or seen at least pictures of people sailing in Greece know that there is wind there, and there is fantastic wind. Turkey has, according to the Turkish government, 48 gigawatt potential for wind development, according to Vienna University, which has much better research. Are there Turkish politicians here? No, okay. Much better research than the Turkish ministry and TSOs. According to Vienna University research, they have 148 gigawatt potential in wind. Turkey has fantastic wind potential. So, and all this potential is in an area which is massive. Southeast Europe, if we take the big kind of geography of Southeast Europe, is, I don't know, from Baku to Milan. I mean, all this area. These are 200 million people with definitely the most abundant renewable energy resource, which is naturally used by individuals, by small companies, very often objected by governments, but it's moving. And the big question No, and here I think this will be the second time when somebody will thank Mr. Putin today. I mean, what happened in Russia tells us that, well, you have to think how to make use of this, of whatever you have. And suddenly Southeast Europe realizes that it has something huge and massive and very economically attractive. And of course, here the big burden. There are many burdens there. We've done various studies, what exactly the burdens are and what is happening. But it boils down to one thing. There is no unified political voice and unified political support for closer cooperation in energy policies, infrastructure, and markets. Southeast Europe is probably the only corner of Europe which doesn't have a kind of stronger drive for development of integrated regional electricity market. I mean, I would be interested to hear a bit more about Baltic states, but I think there is already more development there in that direction. And countries are working in a very on the Balkans in a very Balkan way. They're kind of blocking each other, and as a result of that, because the countries are quite small, individual countries can develop massive generation capacity, as is the case with Bulgaria. Bulgaria has 14 gigawatt generation capacity in electricity and uses 4, and trying to export some and exports 1 or 2. So the main thing on the mind of Bulgarian government is every week they said, so what shall we do next week, what power plants we should shut down and how to reduce the generation of electricity. At the same time, Bulgaria is doing everything possible not to join regional power market because it's afraid that a regional power market will give an opportunity to Romania to sell electricity to Turkey rather than Bulgaria selling it. And these are things that are happening all the time everywhere. I mean, I know hundreds of things about Bulgaria, but also you can see this in other countries. It's a very interesting, the case in Kosovo, for instance, which insists to be energy independent. And this so notion nowadays of being energy independent is kind of out of question. Nobody could be energy independent. You can have energy security, but not energy independence. And this is the kind of things that we have to break. We have to break it through very high level political support and cooperation, which is on level of parliaments, and level of ministers, and level of heads of states. And of course, we should expect very much support from the European Commission on kind of pushing this support, not just the individual projects. We heard this morning that Bulgaria has to build the line between one point and another. This is in southern Bulgaria. This is very important, but what is even more important is to get the heads of states and the parliamentarians in Southeast Europe, in the same way in Northeast Europe, to work together to accelerate the integration of the electricity markets. And of course, to unblock various interconnectors with the gas interconnectors, but this is the story of South Stream and it's very, very complicated. That's for dinner discussion. I would be very happy to talk to anybody about that. So these are just a few introductory words on the huge potential that we have in this most vulnerable part of the world, which has very high dependency on Russian gas, and how this dependency can be decreased and eliminated. And I'm not talking about we will not buy gas from Russia. And we'll buy, of course, gas from Russia, and also we don't want Putin to be very, very poor, because you never know what he'll do after that. We want to have an open market choice in what kind of gas, where to buy it, how much to buy it, and also to find a way to replace coal with gas. But mainly when we talk about this part of the world, to develop rapidly renewables and energy efficiency. Again, this is the most energy inefficient part of Europe, and that's huge energy resource. So I'll stop here, and I hope that I drew several questions that could inspire the next speakers. Or thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Popov. Now we will jump to the Baltics, and I will ask Mr. Vakar to give us a short overview of the energy security and view from the Baltic states.
Thank you. Oh, nice. I really first have to say and apologize about my voice. Today's morning I asked coffee, and then waitress told that, wow, you have so sexy voice. No, I don't have sexy voice. I got cold in Estonia. We don't have this kind of summer day like here. We have -2 yesterday. Because of that, if no one or someone will not understand me, then sorry, I have to do it twice. But point of view Estonia and politics, then energy security topic is really important. For introduction, we can say that Estonia and other Baltic states are among the countries most dependent on external energy resources. Approximately, a big amount of Estonian, Lithuanian and Latvian energy comes from Russia, one way or another. As regards energy issues, the three Baltic states are rather bound and in quite a similar situation. I want to point out strategic development plans of energy must include the energy security issues. Since business enterprises which operate in the energy sector act in the market on a commercial basis, it is important to find the levers of market regulations to ensure that aspects essential to state security are also taken into account by these companies. International developments is climate and energy policy means that all countries are facing major challenges. Like I heard, special facts in politics. We have nowadays 15% renewable energy. We have connecting two links called Estlink 1 and Estlink 2 to Finland. But of course, we have to integrate more EU energy networks. This is point one. Secondly, for information, all Baltic electricity networks remain synchronized with Russian Northwest Current. This is one really, really important point. And of course, if we look at Estonian energy policy, the main part of energy will come of oil shale. And if you look at this green part of oil shale, then I think no more words about that topic today here. While on the subject of strengthening energy security in the region, that is necessary to build even more new connections, integrate energy markets, diversify suppliers, and create LNG terminal capacities in the Nordic Baltic region. Like our Foreign Minister Paet said, that crisis in Ukraine revealed a need for action, a need to reduce energy dependence and develop renewable energy. Even more, if you look at Estonian foreign policy in the big picture, then on the subject of developments in Ukraine, then and Russian aggression, is issues related to energy security have become particularly relevant. if up until now we could talk about the need to improve energy security and renewable energy in theory without time pressure, then the current situation requires us to act, because we know Russia is using energy policy to pressure Ukraine and its other neighbors. Only words are not anymore needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vakra. So before we start the panel, I will just highlight what is the main topic of the workshop. We heard this week and last week from the commissioners designated and vice presidents several definitions about energy security. And one of the answers is, okay, we need to diversify the supply and pathways of the oil and gas. Only this, fail. Then I suppose that nobody mentioned the actual nuclear and imported and more import the coal from the United States, for example. There are several attempts to highlight the importance of the shale gas. Nobody mentioned that, okay, always you have the wording about green growth, green jobs, renewables, we need to invest in the energy efficiency, but that was like you go to people in the school learning the lesson and present it at the hearings. Today we heard from the Mrs. Donnelly really a good message that the energy security means that we need to substitute the energy we import for the heating, because there is no so much problem with the electrical power system. And that this substitute must be done with the sustainable alternative fuels, especially renewables. And here we have the experts from experts in the several technologies in renewable sector. And I will put now the general question for all of you: how you will see the possibility that Southeastern Europe and Baltics substitute dependency of the imported gas from the Russia and also from other parts? They are not can be excluded as sure partners in supplying the gas, as Mr. Popov already said, that the Middle East is obviously is not such secure as sometimes we think. So I will start with from the left side, from Natalie to
yes.
Possibly ask these questions: how the biomass can be some substitution of the gas we imported?
Yes. So thank you. So clearly, this crisis is a heating crisis, and there are today technologies using renewable sources of energy that are available. You have, of course, geothermal, solar thermal, or biomass. And this technology can provide energy from low temperature to high temperature, so to household or industry. So these technologies are available today, and we just need to use them. When it comes to biomass, more specifically, when we see in the Baltic countries a very high dependency rate towards Russian gas, when we see the huge untapped forest potential that they have in the Baltic countries, and when we see the tradition of district heating, there is a huge potential there for switching those district heating from gas to biomass. And we have very good examples of CHP or biomass heating district heating that have switched and that have been financed by the EU cohesion funds in Latvia in the Baltic countries. So now you're going to tell me, if there is this technology available, and why don't we use it? Well, there are some barriers, and I will maybe just mention three of them. The first one is that there is an important upfront investment cost that is linked to using those technologies. And it's there are funds that are available, but most of the time, awareness, people don't know how to activate those funds. So there is huge work of information on how to activate those funds, because funds are available, and I think we're going to have a presentation on this tomorrow morning. Then the second point is, and it has been mentioned many times today, is awareness. Those technologies are available, but the heating sector is very decentralized, and so it's very difficult to reach those key players that are installers, architects, technical planners, those people that are very difficult, it's very difficult to reach them. So it's important to increase the information and to get them aware of what is available. And also it gives them, I mean, if we have, for example, targets at the EU level, binding targets, or if we have an important information campaign at the EU level or national level, it gives a signal to this key players in the heating sector. It gives a signal, where is the future? This is where I have to invest, and it will incentivize them to get trained on how to use those technology, and this is how we could as well develop the use of this technology. And then a final point maybe is and it has also been mentioned by Mary Donnelly, is the fact that there is state intervention in fossil fuels. And it is clearly not creating a level playing field today for renewables. And so this is also an important barrier that we see today. I just wanted to mention also, you mentioned about gas diversification, and the European Commission has proposed a strategy, and mainly the strategy for energy security was about gas diversification. And there is a very interesting study by the Energy Watch Group that has been released on gas diversification, and it's very interesting because basically they said that the energy security will never be reached only with gas diversification, because neither Russia, neither any other gas-producing country will be a reliable supplier in the future, just because there is an increased demand and there is too much competition. And the study mentioned the need to invest in renewables as a solution. Just gonna keep here.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Mr. Diaz, regarding the solar thermal, which is, solar is usually connected with the photovoltaics, and people usually forget that we can heat the water by the solar.
Thank you very much. It's true, it's a usual misconception that solar is mostly about electricity, and it's also about producing heat. And Natalie mentioned the energy security crisis is primarily a heat crisis. So we're talking about 41% of the gas in Europe being used at residential level. We're talking about 31% being used for industry, and one quarter being used for power generation. So it's clearly there that we need these, the sectors, industry and residential mainly, that we need to tackle in order to reduce the dependency. I would like to mention not only solar, I'll get to solar, but some factors that make a huge difference in putting some of the solutions forward, because we know that there are solutions out there, and they are, as it was said this morning, they are no-brainers, they make sense. We lack the political will to put them forward. And the question is very simple. We don't put enough attention to the heating system in the policy discussions. I don't know if you're aware of the Pareto principle, which is a principle of the sparsity of resources, like 20% of our efforts produce 80% of the results. or it can be used for companies like 20% of the product generate 80% of the turnover. In energy, we put it the other way around. We put 80% of our political discussions on 25% of the energy needs, which is electricity. And we forgot that 50% is about heating and cooling. And we need to dedicate then at least 50% of our political discussions to heating and cooling, because finding the solutions. Nathalie mentioned some of them, I'm not going to repeat. Technical solutions are there, we need to make them viable to be implemented at the local level. Going back to energy security, Ms. Donnelly mentioned today two main factors. One was energy moderation, the other one was endogenous sources, namely renewables. Energy generation is important because I also had some problems with my voice. Two times I visited Romania during the winter, because you go inside a building and it seems like it's 36 degrees inside, and outside it's snowing. This is pointing out, and I also have a family. My wife is Macedonian, so I have family in Skopje. And the way it is used to moderate the temperature in the house during the winter is to open the doors, because the central district heating system is not possible to regulate, and there is too much waste. So there is a lot to do also on that part, on energy efficiency, of course, but I think energy moderation even goes a bit further than that. But then there is a lot to do on the transition, and the Commission has recommended to Member States on the energy security strategy for Member States to switch from fossil fuels to renewable heating and cooling. But they didn't go further than this. And they didn't put on the strategy measures from themselves. They just say, Member States should do this. And this is the Pareto principle the other way around, as I was saying before. We're not putting enough efforts into this from the Commission and from the national level. Because the solutions are feasible and are possible, and we just need to find the best mechanism to activate. On the solar thermal, we have solutions for that can be applicable on the short term, and this is a main concern. The short term is not tomorrow. There is no solution that will solve our problem tomorrow. I have serious doubts of the solutions that can be found immediately for this winter. That is a big concern, and I think in particular for the Baltic states, I know a lot of people many people are very anxious about this, and I think there are reasons to do so. But there are also the concerns on the short term should not make us forget the need to find sustainable solutions. And Ms. Donnelly also mentioned this today. So the fact that we are looking into replacing as fast as we can, we should not forget the medium and long term, and that our solutions should be take into account the different factors, not only environmental, but also stability of prices. And I give you the example of an interesting case for solar district heating in Denmark. Denmark is not known as being the most sunny place in the world. They are supposed to, here they are the happiest people in the world, but not the sunniest. But they have some of the biggest solar thermal plants in the world. Not anymore the biggest, they are already overtaken by some others outside of Europe, but they have the biggest ones in Europe and some of the biggest in the world. And without subsidies, this is a business case. Of course, Denmark is a particular country where, with the high energy costs policy, which also helps to make this business model viable, but they have district heating supported 100% with renewables, for example, where 55% comes from solar heat, solar thermal, and 45% from other sources, including biomass. And these are replicable in Baltic states also. And of course, this is also replicable in district heating networks in Southeast Europe. So it's the business model is there, the technology is there, it's just waiting to be taken and implemented. So there is no reason to put a stamp on this, fail to scale, there's no point in putting this because it's there. It's a question of political will. It's a question of giving 50% of our political decisions attention to heating and cooling. But we should not forget the need to think of a transition of our energy system. The energy strategy of the Commission failed to diversify, because what they do is to propose a diversification of gas. And energy diversification is much more than that. We cannot depend too much on one single energy source. And the competition in the market requires that we have different technologies in place and we have different energy sources in place. And this competition will provide better options for the consumer in terms of costs and in terms of technology. And with this prospect in mind and building this transition, we need to address the refurbishment of buildings, as it was discussed, but we need to combine the measures that are possible in terms of energy efficiency with renewability and cooling. They are the two faces of the same coin. Energy efficiency, reducing the demand, and supplying that demand with renewables. And we need to focus the mechanisms that are available, namely at European level, to focus into investment from private investment in the houses, in changing our the systems in our homes, and as such, giving steps to the change of the energy system as a whole. And of course, I raise one issue that is one of the things that our technology can be very good, which is the production of hot water. So when we're talking about energy efficiency, we will reduce a lot our demand for space heating, but we'll still have a similar demand for domestic hot water. Solar thermal is already a competitive today option for domestic hot water, and also with alternatives for space heating. But wanting to defend my technology, I will say that it's much more than that. So it's a technology that, together with other renewable heating and cooling, together with the renewable electricity, together with energy efficiency, can change our energy system. And this is what we should keep in mind and putting our thoughts and our will into putting it into practice, because it's already feasible today.
Thank you, Mr. Diaz. Now I will ask Mr. Sanner to explain us the potentials and possibility to use the geothermal energy as a substitute for the imported fossil fuels.
Yeah, thank you very much. And first, I'd like to shortly check the opportunities a government has when it comes to energy security. And one is to start investing in the military forces to fight or keep the way to the sources clear and protect the sources outside the country. And we know that there are some states in this world that have chosen partly that way, and it's changing now. The other is to look for your indigenous energy sources. And renewable energies are for sure an indigenous source. There are others, so it's important to look at the sustainability. Again, these other states that also have a very strong military arm, they are exploiting indigenous sources like shale gas. And what we find also, I have to say, I'm a geologist by profession, so the shale gas issue is quite of interest for me. But if you look at how this is done and what are the consequences, in a continent that is as populated as Europe, or a continent also where we have this high environmental standards as in Europe, all the production methods that are used across the Atlantic will not work. So I'm not very much afraid that we'll see much competition as renewables from shale gas, because it will not be economic here. Or if it is done economical way, then it is not tolerable. Well, it can be economic if the gas price goes through the ceiling, but that again is not really to be anticipated. I've seen recently a study from Ludwig Boelcke Foundation where they were putting some figures on shale gas, and it was the other energy sources were over the time very stable, but then shale gas was just a peak in that scenario. And I think that is a bit telling. So we have to look for the indigenous sources that are there, and so I come to the geothermal. Of course, we have the sun shining, we have the biomass. The sun, well, biomass actually is also stored solar energy. Without sun, we have very little biomass, somewhere in the ocean maybe. Geothermal energy is an energy that is coming from inside the earth, and it is also not just from the beginning when the earth was created, but it's still about two-thirds of it is generated continuously from, well, we have to admit that, it's nuclear fraction that happens down, deep down in the earth. Natural processes that create heat. So we have a tremendous amount of heat. It's about 40 terawatt that Earth is continuously radiating into outer space. But it is, to use it, we have to look very closely at the places where it can be done. And the southeast and the east of Europe is actually a very good place to look at. So let's say from Poland, Lithuania, to Turkey, all the way, all the countries have a potential there. One country with a particularly good potential is Hungary, and we've recently concluded a European, an IEA-funded project called GeoDH, where the Hungarian Geological Survey was coordinating a potential study for all this area and found out that about 25% of people in the EU live in places where, for instance, geothermal district heating could be done. So if you Google geodh.eu, you'll find all this documentation there. As Pedro said, it's a heating crisis, so this is an issue to have, for instance, district heating or to have also other smaller uses of geothermal energy for heat. Looking up to the Baltic states, to the north, we are seeing that there is more or less, for electricity, no potential. I'd say there is, in the foreseeable future, we'll not see any geothermal power production in the Baltic states. We do not have district heating north of Lithuania. There is one plant in Klaipėda. But you might like to look across to Sweden or to Finland that are in similar situation where the geothermal heat pumps, the shallow geothermal system, is very, very widely used with a very good success. So there is a potential there that could be used. Finally, because this is heat is one point, but we also energy security comprises naturally the electricity and the heat sector, and also of course the transport sector. We have to have sustainable solutions, secure solutions for all of them. There is this problem with the renewable energies, in particular in the electricity sector, being discredited in the past, and that happened, it started very slowly, and there are basically two lines on which they had been discredited. One was, and it was said somehow before, that there's the price. It started slowly, and in particular in Germany, where there are some large power producers, the political and the media, the political sector of the media, started taking up the issue of the prices. And meanwhile, there is a complete shift to focus on price. In that respect, I'm quite happy that the Hinkley C case showed us how the real price ratio is for electricity production. Also, we see that the prices for electricity on the market for the producers are actually going down, while still the consumers do not see the benefit of that. It's not only taxes, it's also profits. And the second is the discretization renewables are not dependable. I hear in my country, Germany, that with a high res renewable energy share, we have more, the lights will go black in winter, probably, if there is no sunshine and no wind, in one day we'll not have. But this isn't the case. We do not need to be afraid of the renewables and of the varying nature of some of the renewables, which is there. But with the smarter grids, I'm not talking about new storage concepts. we need some storage, but we do not need to have to invent completely new things that are far in the future. It's already here. With decentralization and in particular with the use of flexible renewable energies, those renewable energy that are able to supply on demand and not when there is some potential there, some production, those together, those two types of renewables together can be the solution. And the we see more interest now in this flexible, which includes biomass, of course, geothermal, ocean. These are things that can help to, let's say, show that renewables in total can be a dependable thing. And so this is where I think the way might go to have a secure and clean energy supply.
Today we heard a lot of energy efficiency, but nobody mentioned the one important part of this directive is a high efficiency cogeneration. And in the directive also is written that it will be supported, the cogeneration not above 20 megawatts. And we have, if you look at from the north, the Baltics, to the south, the high efficiency cogeneration is more profitable in the north than in the south. In the south we have probably problem to get high efficiency cogeneration because of climate is more warmer. But I will ask the Mr. Popov if he can give us some ideas. Is it possible to tie the electricity market and heat market to be more efficient?
I mean, I think one of the issues is how to when we're talking about integration of the European energy markets, is also how to develop a market for efficiency. And that's a bit complicated. It's sophisticated, but it is one of the keys to develop further the integration of the market, but also to promote to drive through the energy efficiency policies. We heard many times today how energy efficiency in buildings specifically just don't work. There were mentioned cases that 75% of private ownership, high fragmentation of ownership that prevents large-scale projects, but this could be one of the ways to include the energy efficiency into the overall energy market. I don't know whether that answers the question with the efficient cogeneration, but it is about the energy efficiency, how we have to start treating them. Because energy efficiency is a massive potential, and everybody talks about it almost like we love talking about multiculturalism, for instance. But when it comes to implementation, nobody knows what exactly to do. So this could be one of the ways.
Thank you. Now we have some questions. Okay.
First. Probably not questions, but some remarks concerning Lithuania and Baltic states. What concerns, security of energy supply, and we know that we had learned lessons when, the oil pipeline was closed, probably forever, because after that, of course, we started think our magic, as you say, because the supply can't be shut completely from Russia, because at the end is but Nord Stream, it's for the attention of Germany. If they make, it will be possible. Of course, by the end of this year in Klaipeda will start functioning LNG. I'm very regretful that, other Baltic countries didn't sign for this project, and it's we made it on our own money, but I address our Latvian colleagues, because the capacity of LNG is, it's enough for three Baltic countries, and even for Finland too. So what we need the interlink to Inčukalnis, the gas storage, and after that, from Inčukalnis to probably to Estland. So this is my one of remarks. Another remark is by the year of 2000, by the end of 2015, we estimate to have Svedlink that interconnects us with Nordic countries, Nordic energy market, and I'm not sure whether we should close our interconnection with Volga basin, because until now we receive comparatively cheap electricity, and Estonia and Latvia is using this too. What concerns central heating system, we are shifting from natural gas to biomass, and smaller municipalities already had shifted by nearly by 100%. The bigger ones, there is estimate that only 20% of natural gas will be left for peak consumption. What concerns solar, of course, there were made mistakes, and we were to do the, unfortunately, this was not done because of what I'm raising the question. Probably we had more renewables if the consumer would be put on the center of attention, and some subsidies for personal investments concerning solar would be made for purchasing solar batteries or whatever. So I think it would be more wise than that, and it would be more spread. So I shift my microphone to my colleague. He will tell more.
No, I won't tell more. My name is Linas Balsys. I'm also a member of parliament, as my colleague Birutė Vėsaitė. Actually, I'd like just to make a few remarks and to demystify what the Baltic situation really is. Rainer started from Estonia and the Estlink 1 and Estlink 2. Going down south, we find Latvia, another country, and Lithuania, and we find two strange entities, as my colleague mentioned, Kaliningrad exclave and Belarus. So all these five countries, including Kaliningrad exclave, creates electricity-wise, creates the Baltic states region. So, and as Rainer rightly said, we all are integrated and synchronized with the so-called BRELL ring, which is Belarus, Russia, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. It's an abbreviation. So, what does it mean? Does it matter we are, you know, totally not independent? No, it does not. We technically synchronized, but with the projects which are going on under very nice thing, which is called BMIP, which is Baltic Energy Market Integration Plan. It's European Union plan. And in this respect, we are much happier than Iberian Peninsula, because we do have a plan of interconnections, and we're very, very happy with it. So under this plan falls the Swedlink, or the Nordlink, the 700 megawatts capacity line from Sweden to Lithuania. And it Litpolink, another link funded by the European Union to Poland, also pretty powerful. These two links, they are not designed to synchronize or to resynchronize with the continental Europe. These two links, they only are designed because they are of the DC power. Direct current power. So you cannot use them for the synchronization. You can only use them for import and export. So, but do we need this resynchronization? Maybe yes, but that's not technically, it's not important. So politically, maybe yes, but the European Commission now is under the having negotiations with Russia on the joint administration of this Russian ring. So that's good news. Regarding the resynchronization from BRELL to continental Europe, it could be a problem, because I mentioned this strange entity of exclave of Kaliningrad. We can't exclude it. So. And the Swedish company Gotia Power just made recently a study which says that we can resynchronize to continental Europe with Kaliningrad, without Kaliningrad. But in any case, we cannot exclude it. So if we go with Kaliningrad, we have Russia, which will interrupt all the time, do all the possible obstacles, use it as a political instrument, and, you know. If we go without Kaliningrad, Russia will start crying and shouting and maybe shooting, telling that we are violating Russia's rights. And they will be right. Under the international treaties, we cannot just exclude Kaliningrad. Or it would mean cut off from the grid. We cannot do that. So I think it would be much wiser to forget for some time the resynchronization business. Even I know that Estonian and Latvian colleagues are not so keen about this resynchronization. It could be very costly. And go on with the Baltic Energy Market Integration Plan. For that, we need to create the Baltic market. Do we have the Baltic market in the energy sector? Yes and no. We do have in the electricity, because we all are administratively included into the Nord Pool spot system. With the Swedlink and Litpolink and Estlink 1 and 2, and with the some not that big investments in between the three Baltic states to delete the bottlenecking problems in the power lines, we are perfectly functioning part of the Nord Pool spot system. That's a Scandinavian electricity market. And we're perfectly have access to cheap and always available electricity from the Scandinavian market. Norwegian and Swedish hydropower and our own. So, having all this in mind, we're not an island, and we're totally capable of have cheap electricity at any time, at any quantity. That's the very three important things. Then we have another question. Should we produce generation of our own or not? The best answer would be not, from the economical point of view, because we can buy cheaply any time. From the political and strategical security point, of course, each country has to have its own generation capacity in case all the power lines, all the interconnections fail. Do we have in Lithuania enough of generation capacity? Yes, we do. Our at the current moment, our installed generation capacity is twice as bigger as our needs. We only need 10 terawatts per year. Our capacity is twice as bigger. We have 4,000 megawatts of installed power. Why don't we import still 66% of Russian electricity? That because it's cheaper. Can we survive if we don't have Russian power? Yes, we can. Yes, there was some technical problems in this Russian ring a year ago. We were fully functioning on our own. The biggest problem is that the biggest generator, the gas power plant in the middle of Lithuania, is on gas. The gas was, you know, dependent on Russia, and it was expensive. But we can run the other part of this power plant on diesel, on mazut, on whatever, if we wish. So we don't have technical problem of supplying enough electricity on our own. It's a question of price. With the LNG terminal, maybe we becoming totally independent. The price won't be lesser, but we will have enough of gas. 4 billion cubical meters of gas. That's enormous amount. Okay, so
we run out of the time. So
yeah, so finishing it, and do we have renewable resources? Yes, in Lithuania we have, Natalie knows better than me, enormous resources of biomass, 2.2 million tons of oil equivalent. That's, we only use 800,000. So we have huge, huge, huge resources. And if we go to the cogeneration, as you Davor say, and we are planning to do that with the heating system switching to the biomass, we don't have no problems at all. So we're not an island and we're totally independent. It's just a matter of policy, and we're on the right track.
Thank you very much for your comments and inputs. Unfortunately, we don't have more time, and I suppose that we can continue our conversation during the dinner. Thank you for coming, and see you later. And thank you for the panelists.
I have one more comment to make for those who are going back to Lapa Palace. There are, yes, the buses are standing outside of the main entrance. Sorry, but we'll see you in the castle for dinner. Yes.